Hello everyone, this is the first talk for a series that I'm doing, the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage by Shurdo Shichian. Unfortunately, the first talk that I gave, we didn't have the recorder with us, so what I'm going to do now is essentially kind of recreate the talk so at least it can be posted online. And those of you who missed the first talk can listen to it and then catch up with the second, third, and fourth. And we'll make sure that we bring our voice recorder to the following talks. So at the beginning of the talk, first of all, we recited the poem together. And I'm going to post the poem online so that you'll have it there to look at. Before you listen to the talk, though, if you would like to have a look at the poem online, I would suggest that you read it over to yourself once or twice. And maybe during the second time, just note or underline, if you printed it out, anything in the poem that stands out for you. Maybe seems a little bit strange or maybe very powerful in some way. But just take note of that, where that is, what that is. And then once you've done that, which is a good way, I think, to kind of settle in and think a little bit about the poem before you start listening to the talks. So I'll assume you've done that, and let's jump in here. I think I'll begin by talking a little bit about Shurdo Shichian, the ancestor who composed this poem and left it for us. He was born around 700 AD, and it's said that he had lived until he was 90 years of age. And when we look at the records, you know, a large number of the old Zen ancestors are recorded to have lived very long lives. But it's good to remember that in ancient China, well, I guess it's still in China today, a long life was a symbol of good fortune and also of spiritual attainment. So I think we need to take any old age records of one of the ancestors with a bit of a grain of salt. Indeed, we can't know the accuracy of the documents that discuss the details of Shurdo's life, because everything, or almost everything, was recorded after his death. But according to his biography, he grew up near Guangzhou, which is in the southwest of China. And as a small child, he visited Zen temples with his mother. During one of those visits, she brought him in front of a large Buddha image and told him to bow down. And she said, "This is Buddha." After he had bowed, young Shurdo looked at the image for a while and then said, "This is only a human being. If he is called a Buddha, then I want to be one too." So he was obviously quite precocious, or at least they wanted him to appear that way in the records. It seems clear from the records that Shurdo took his understanding of the teachings of Buddhism very much to heart, even as a young boy. In his village, they still practiced animal sacrifices to appease the local spirits by leaving tethered cows near makeshift altars in the woods and then slaughtering them. Now, the practice of sacrifice was fairly common in ancient China, mostly disappeared by the time Shurdo was born, but the early Chinese also practiced human sacrifice, and so in many of the large tombs, we can find the remains of human sacrifice there. But anyway, Shurdo would sneak out and break the ceremonial altars that the elders had set up and release the animals. And that must have really frustrated those village elders, since according to the biography, they were never really able to stop him. And then finally, as a young teenager, he left home and went to practice Buddhism. He practiced briefly under the sixth patriarch, Huineng, and then later under a disciple of Huineng. He must have been really a quite bright and probably a pretty influential person, since he is recorded as an ancestor in the lineage of four different schools of Zen, including our school of Zen, the Soto school of Zen. And although there are only two pieces of writing that we have today, that are attributed to Sherdo, the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, which we're discussing now, and then the Harmony of Difference and Equality. It's really clear from these poems and from other references that Sherdo had studied Buddhist philosophy, as well as devoted himself to a life of practice. So even though we only have these two pieces of his own writing, and I should perhaps mention there's also some dialogues that we have recorded as well. Dialogues are kind of Zen koans in the form of dialogues between Sherdo and his some of his students. So we have that as well. Over the course of his life, he did have many students. And as I mentioned earlier, he's really one of the key ancestors in our particular lineage. In his middle age, Sherdo moved to South Peak Temple on South Mountain in the southern part of Hunan Province, where he built a hut just to the east of the temple on a large flat stone. And at that point, he took the name Sherdo, which means stone, or more literally, stone head. And I don't think that actually refers to his physical head, but maybe, you know, the shape of the rock that he had built his hut on, or that somehow the rock stuck out in a way. And often Buddhist teachers in China would take on the name of the place where they were living, or some prominent geological feature would become their name. And perhaps that was in part just to make it easier for people to find them. I'm not really sure when that custom began or the reason for it. But in a way you could think of it, you know, that old teacher so-and-so is living under some kind of prominent, say, pine tree or some kind of cave, and then he'd be called, Big Pine Teacher, or Cave on the Fourth Mountain Teacher, something like that. The temple and the rock where Sherdo built his hut are still there today. During this time when Sherdo lived, most Zen practice and training happened in monasteries, just as it does today. But it seems that Sherdo perhaps wanted to bring back the practice of living and of practicing as a hermit, in addition to living in a monastery. Now that in early times, often Buddhism was practiced more in a kind of hermetic tradition, but and Taoism, of course, was very much a hermit tradition. But by the time Sherdo was alive, these large monasteries, often in the countryside, away from cities, were established. And that probably made it much easier for the monks to live rather than by themselves in some isolated place. Now, Sherdo's South Peak Temple was destroyed in the Cultural Revolution, but it was rebuilt in the 80s with the help of the Japanese Soto Zenshu, the Japanese Soto Zen organization. And today, there's a number of practicing monks and nuns living there. So, as a place of practice, it is still vibrant. As I mentioned earlier, there are only two poems left that we can trace back to Sherdo, though there are a number of recorded dialogues that he had with the students in addition to the bibliography. And one of those two poems have been very influential over the ages. Today, the Sandokai, or how we translate it, at least at the present moment, the harmony of difference and unity, is chanted almost daily in most of the traditional Soto Zen temples throughout Japan and here in North America. And at Mountain Rain Zen, we chant it about once or maybe twice a month during our regular service. And it's a poem that expresses Sherdo's understanding of the way things are, how things are both separate and intimate with everything else at the same moment. Towards the end of his life, Shindo Suzuki Roshi, the Japanese Zen monk who brought this school of Zen and the practice of Zen to North America, he gave a series of lectures on the Sandokai, or on this harmony of difference and unity. And these have been published in a book called The Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness. And I recommend that book to you as a way to get a taste of Sherdo's understanding, and also how contemporary Zen teachers express and understand that. But the poem we're going to be looking at for the next 4 weeks is less well known, but still studied in Zen centers and temples, and that's the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. Much less philosophical than the Harmony of Difference and Unity, it really offers a view of practice and life that asks us to turn inward and to illumine our own life. And Sherdo gives us some hints and directions to help us do that. So let's jump into the first couple of lines of the poem. So the first two lines go, I've built a grass hut where there is nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. There is something about a hut that is very alluring. When I was a boy, I fairly often built simple huts and forts. In the winter, when it snowed, my brother and I would haul out a kind of crude plywood table that I think my dad had made from the basement. And then using it as a framework, we would pack snow all around it to make a snow hut, a kind of artless igloo, where we'd read comic books and, you know, drink cocoa and eat snacks. I wonder if you ever made play huts from blankets and chairs, or perhaps you had a tree house when you were growing up. When I come across a hut when hiking, a sense of safety arises in me, and a sense of curiosity. I always want to see inside. Looking inside most huts on a trail, there's really almost nothing to see. Most of them are just crude shelters, with maybe a plywood frame for a sleeping bag or a place to hang food out of the reach of mice. Yet even though the interior is often dark, I usually imagine myself living there for a while. Solitary, quiet, content. Memories of those simple huts of childhood, the rough huts found occasionally on long trails, awaken the possibility of a life not entangled with material clutter, a life unburdened, even for a short time, of email, cell phones, TVs, cars, computers, of being on time for work, shopping, taking care of others. For me, a hut is a refuge from our workaday world. It is a place where our life shifts from doing to being. The huts of childhood or on the trail are where we stop and rest, where we be rather than do. Sherdo was an abbot and a teacher, probably a busy man with lots of responsibilities. I don't know when he wrote this poem. I don't think it's recorded. But I imagine him building a simple grass hut, not too far, but not too close either, from the monastery. And there he takes refuge from the busyness of his life. One of the aspects that makes a refuge a true refuge is that there is nothing of value. It is small, unadorned, spare. There are few, if anything, that will spark concern or that we need to worry about in a hut. Taigu Gyokan, a Zen master and poet who lived, I think born around 1750 and died in, 1830 kind of thing. He was one of Japan's most beloved poets, and known for his great kindness, his simple life, and his playfulness with children. He often wrote haiku, and I'd like to read to you one of these haiku. He wrote this haiku after a thief had entered his small hut and stole his few possessions that were there. And Gyokan wrote, "The thief left it behind, the moon at my window." Nothing of value may also imply a kind of dropping of comparing mind, the tendency we have to hold dear to something because of its monetary or sentimental value, while treating roughly what we consider less significant. I remember my Aikido teacher in Japan, Mr. Hayakawa, would often press a visitor who had expressed an interest or admiration of something in Mr. Hayakawa's home to take it. Books, Japanese tea bowls, bags of tea and other things that Mr. Hayakawa had been given would before long find new owners. His visitors soon learned to offer praise with caution. Mr. Hayakawa was a generous man, and one of the strongest lessons I learned from him was the expansive power of an unstinting act. But he was also free with what little he had because he saw the transitory nature of it. Where there's nothing of value. If there is nothing of value there, then where is value? What is of value? What is important? At the very beginning of this poem, Sherdo strikes close to the heart of our everyday life, because we place value on almost everything. Just notice how you feel when your cell phone is missing, when the car acts up, when the computer doesn't reboot, when the Netflix app doesn't work, when you slop coffee on your favorite sweater. Buddhist psychology understands this placing of value as identifying with. In some way, my sense of I, me, and mine is woven into the car, the cell phone, the sweater, and when those things don't operate the way I want or they get damaged, I too am subtly attacked, I too am subtly damaged and suffer. And isn't this true of our relationships as well? How painful it is not to be loved the way we want. According to the Buddhist tradition, the first sermon that the Buddha taught after awakening was in Sarnath, India. And it's called today the setting in motion of the wheel of Dharma. In this sermon, the Buddha explained to his first disciples the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is that of dukkha or dissatisfaction, that all temporary things and states are ultimately unsatisfying. The second is dukkha arises because we crave and cling to these things or states. We want something to be different than it is, or we want something we don't have. For most of us, when the truth of dukkha becomes clear in our life in some way, and that our usual ways of coping with this dissatisfaction, with this suffering, our usual ways just don't work, that is when we begin to question. And questioning is what guides us away from our many assumptions and towards our life. Sherdo's practice and our practice are not very different, we begin to question, in this life, the one that I live right now, what is of true value? What is truly important? This questioning never ends, for the answers are never complete, and like all things, the answers change. Sherdo looks around his hut and says, there is nothing of value. At this point in the poem, he doesn't say what is of value, but he deeply knows what is not of value, and that in itself is freeing. An integral part of our own practice is the courage to keep asking the real questions. We ask, and then we let go of the question and get on with our life. But after a while, we pause and ask again and listen for a few moments before getting back to our job. In your life, what is of true value? What is truly important? These questions are true friends guiding us into a clear and spacious life. So I'm going to end here, but I'd like to suggest if you're following along week by week as we explore this poem in more depth, I would like you to read the poem every day, in the morning or in the evening, whenever you have time, a few moments of settledness. Just read through it out loud if you can. And the second thing that I would ask is simply to reflect on what is important in your life, what is of true value. And you may receive answers, and that's wonderful. But even when you receive the answer, you know, hold it, cherish it, look at it, put it down, and then after a bit again, maybe the next day, what is of true value? What is really important in this life for me, for now? Thank you for listening.